I'd like to let you know that Aussie Meter is sponsored by OPC Health, an Australian supplier of prosthetics, orthotics, clinic equipment, compression garments, rehabilitation devices for doctors, physiotherapists, orthotists, podiatrists, and hand therapists. If you'd like to know what OPC Health offers, visit opchealth.com.au and view their range online. No matter what area of medicine you happen to be involved in, prescribing medications is a major part of it. Do you realise there's a whole profession behind the scenes that helps dictate what sort of medications are useful, giving support to both patients, prescribers, as well as government organisations? These are clinical pharmacologists, and today we're going to learn more about what that profession involves. Good day and welcome to AussieMedEd, the Australian Medical Education Podcast, a program born during COVID times to emulate that general chit-chat and banter around the hospital, with the idea of educating the medical student and GP alike. I'm Gavin Nyman, an orthopaedic surgeon based in Adelaide, and it's my pleasure to bring AussieMedEd to you. And in this episode, we're going to be joined by Professor Sapir Shakib, Professor of Clinical Pharmacology at Adelaide University. He's also got an Instagram site where he answers a lot of questions about pharmacology and presents certain cases, and he's going to talk about his role as a clinical pharmacologist. Once again, welcome to AussieMedEd, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast has been produced and pay my respects to the elders both past and present. Well, today I'd like to welcome Professor Sapir Shakib, Professor of Clinical Pharmacology at Adelaide University and host of Instagram site Pharmatine_studies. He's going to talk about clinical pharmacology, and I'd like to welcome him to AussieMedEd. Welcome, Sapir.
Oh, thank you so much. Look, growing up in Iran all those years ago, never did I think that I would end up on a podcast with the very famous Gavin Nyman. So thank you so much. It's an absolute dream to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming along. Well, Sapir, having known you for some time, I always think of you as a very personal person, yet clinical pharmacology always makes me think of a job that actually doesn't involve people as much. What does clinical pharmacology actually involve? And can you tell me a bit what got you into it?
So I decided to do clinical pharmacology because there was a few individuals, so people such as Professor Felix Bochner, who again were very, very amiable, just friendly, lovely individuals. And they were sort of a mentor, and being able to sort of do work like them really sort of inspired me. But I actually decided to become a clinical pharmacologist because I was doing renal one day, and at 10 o'clock at night, I was so agitated because of all the calls I was getting that I decided that just doing full-time 60, 80 hours a week clinical medicine just wasn't right for me. And what I really wanted was a career that had certainly some clinical work, but then some teaching and some research. So it was just a bit better balance. And certainly clinical pharmacology, I found, has been able to offer that. So that was the main attraction, actually, was I just found that seeing patients every day from morning till night, I just found that that was just way too demanding for me and actually just, you know, wasn't good for my mental health.
So what does a clinical pharmacologist actually do? Do you actually review all the medications prescribed at the hospital, or are you there for advice for when people want to know about interactions?
Yeah, so clinical pharmacology is actually very, very broad, and there's lots of us work in lots of different areas. Predominantly, it tends to be in those three areas. So clinical pharmacology is involved in research. So you're absolutely right. A lot of clinical pharmacologists actually do lab-based research, but a lot of the people trained in Adelaide are very, very much at the clinical end. So the research we're interested in is around quality use of medicines, about prescribing, about pharmacoepidemiology, which is how medicines are used in sort of large populations. And particularly recently, looking at how we can improve prescribing with things such as electronic health records and other sort of things. So that's been, you know, a lot of what my research has been involved in is very, very much at the patient end. Clinical pharmacology is also very, very much involved in teaching. So that's teaching around medicines and how to use them and quality use of medicines. And the other part of it is largely around medication governance. And the governance bit is actually the bit that many people just don't like. If you think about it, when we come to using medicines, there are certain rules we have to follow. There's certain medicines we can access and others that we can't access. And clinical pharmacology is often the best position to be able to help determine what those rules should be. So I kind of see that we're able to go from the extreme micro to the extreme macro. You know, I can spend an afternoon in a clinic with individual patients and spend half an hour just looking at all their individual drugs and all their individual doses. And then I might step away from that and I might teach some students about prescribing and how they might manage a similar patient. And then I might step into a role where I'm involved in the drug committee of the hospital when we're looking at the medicines that we should be using and the medicines we shouldn't be using. And then I might be involved at a state or national level looking at medication policy. So clinical pharmacology really sits anywhere along that spectrum. And ultimately, it's about quality use of medicines to try and improve how we use medicine.
That sounds brilliant. So could I assume that you'd be available also for advice for other physicians or surgeons like myself who might want advice about drug interactions? Or in general, do you recommend a particular website or other reference that we could refer to in this situation?
Yeah, so fortunately nowadays, there's so many different resources. So oftentimes people will tend to use something like the Australian Medicine's Handbook as a really, really good source of information about what to do. Nowadays, there's also many clinical pharmacists on the floor, and we're very, very fortunate in Australia. It's a very unique model where pretty much every unit in a public hospital will tend to have a clinical pharmacist that can assist. What you find with clinical pharmacists is that they're very, very good at the medication side, but as part of their training, they don't really get a lot of training around the diagnosis, how to interpret tests, and how to holistically look after the patient. So I guess when you start to get into problems where there's tensions and challenges between different medicines and how you then get the best outcome in a complex patient, then that's often where people tend to call us in. We often tend to get called in for when patients are having unusual medication reactions, but also in certain situations where patients, for example, have got severe hypertension that can't be treated, or oftentimes postural hypotension. And these are often the clinical areas we tend to get involved in. We've started at the Royal Adelaide Hospital the MAX service, which is the Multidisciplinary Ambulatory Consulting Service. And that's essentially a clinic for patients with multiple chronic diseases. So these are patients that would normally go and see, you know, an endocrinologist and a cardiologist and the kidney specialist. And oftentimes those patients find that they go and see multiple different specialists. But because we don't have really good systems for them to all talk to each other, then their care can be fragmented. What we have instead is a kind of a one-stop shop, where we have general physicians and clinical pharmacologists, but we also have nurses, we also have pharmacists, we also have a clinical psychologist to try and provide better integrated care for those complex patients that are on multiple medications.
Excellent. And for someone listening who likes the sound of this sort of profession, I presume you've done your physician training and then done further experience in this area, or is there an advanced degree in pharmacology that takes you down this path?
Yeah, so we're very, very fortunate in Adelaide because we have two units that provide training in clinical pharmacology, and we've had an advanced trainee going back all the way back to probably about 2000. And we actually have more clinical pharmacologists in Adelaide as a result than anywhere else in Australia and possibly the world. So we're very, very fortunate that way. That's right. So basically, a lot of medical subspecialty training. So if you get into physicians training, then a lot of the other subspecialties get into individual organs. So you become an expert in the kidney, become a nephrologist, you become an expert in the heart, become a cardiologist. Some people find that quite limiting, and what they want is something a bit more diverse and a bit broader. I guess the options there, you know, things such as geriatrics or general medicine, they do tend to be very clinically focused. And I guess clinical pharmacology offers the option of being able to see a group of patients that you're able to look after and manage holistically, but also, as I said earlier, be able to offer that option of more teaching, more research, more governance, so that you're a bit broader in terms of your contribution to the healthcare system and hopefully have a better, you know, work-life balance.
And what about research? You're obviously quite involved in that as well. How does that work out? I know the average person might think of research as being a little bit scary if they think they could be involved in it, but I believe it's all very regimented and controlled and very safe way of proceeding, and a very important role of any area of medicine research.
Yeah, so one of the unique areas in Adelaide in clinical pharmacology is we're really fortunate. We've got the biomedical precinct. So we've got SAMRI, two universities, the Royal Adelaide Hospital, and across the road we have CMAX Clinical Research, which is a dedicated research facility. And so our clinicians and academics are able to work across all those kind of sites, but as well get involved in phase one clinical trials at CMAX Clinical Research. So what that involves is we're able to look at information about a new compound, which has never been given to humans before, and assess, you know, what's happened when that's been given to animals for a long period of time under certain controlled conditions, and then look at actually dosing human beings for the very, very first time with that drug. And if you think about every single drug that's out there, every drug that you're taking or, you know, your loved one's taking, at some point that's gone through what's called a phase one study, which is for the first time it was given to human beings for the very, very first time. And that's actually a very regimented and very well regulated process to try and manage the risk of that as much as possible. All our trainees, as well as the clinical pharmacologists that we work with, have been through the process of training on how to do those first-in-man studies, and many of them now work as principal investigators at CMAC's clinical research. Again, from the research perspective, we're able to really get involved in providing advice for the pharmaceutical industry about how to develop their drugs, how to actually do those first-in-man phase one research studies, and then also, you know, look at phase two and phase three studies, involve patients. And as I said earlier, look at how medicines are actually used in practice. Look at pharmacoepidemiology, which is the other end of the spectrum of looking at, you know, drugs that have been used in humans for a long time, and then looking at how they're used together and what the consequences are of using medications together across large populations. So again, it's able to give you the research experience of looking at one individual molecule and administering it to one individual human being, and then pulling back to the helicopter view of how, for example, we use the novel anticoagulants across all of South Australia and then doing research on that. So that's really very, very interesting and very, very broad.
Now, that's very interesting. Now, looking at pharmacology in general, I remember my days at university having to learn about half-lives, efficacy, agonists and antagonists. Can you go through those principles and what the important ones are to know for the medical students or general practitioner thinking about prescribing medications?
So I think I would just sort of preface those comments by saying that they've all been the sort of traditional things that we've talked about for a long time. And it's really easy to get bogged down in a lot of those things. But probably about half the drugs now, which are new drugs approved by the Therapeutic Goods Administration or the Food and Drug Administration, are now very, very different drugs because they're now biologic. Just going back to what you were saying before. So we used to think of medicines as what we call small molecules. So these are individual chemicals. So you might think of a beta blocker, for example, and a beta blocker might be an antagonist. And we might think of a drug such as atenolol as being an antagonist at the beta receptor. And we used to think of concepts such as propranolol as being an antagonist at the beta 1 and the beta 2 receptor. And we used to think of medicines such as salbutamol that we might use for asthma as being an agonist. And so a lot of pharmacology teaching is just kind of teaching those sort of concepts and teaching about partial agonists and agonists and antagonists. A lot of the students will kind of reflect on the fact that actually we tend to use medications such as salbutamol and atenolol, but drugs such as propranolol, we hardly ever use. So a lot of that sort of old-fashioned understanding that we have had about agonists and antagonists and all those sort of things, basically over time, what we found is that we're able to develop newer and better drugs that kind of do what they're meant to without having to worry about, you know, whether it's a partial agonist or whether there's some spillover of acting on one receptor and another receptor. And increasingly nowadays, we have biologics that specifically target a particular enzyme or a receptor or a target. And for many of these, as you said earlier, the half-lives are all pretty similar and they tend to be in the order of weeks. So we used to think previously about a half-life of a drug being short in terms of a few hours or long in terms of, you know, a day or so. And so you might be able to take it a couple of times a day or maybe you're to take it once a day. We increasingly have these biologics that you administer, for example, once a week or once a month. Because they're very, very specific, they're able to achieve the efficacy. And because they don't affect other receptors, they also don't tend to have a lot of adverse effects. So a lot of the understanding that the students have had in the past, and certainly people like yourself and myself, as we went through our pharmacology training, where we used to spend a lot of time talking about these different things, a lot of those understandings are still necessary, but just not as relevant. Instead, with these biologics, the main issue is that they don't necessarily work in everyone. When they work very well. And so this is where precision medicine comes in, where we have to think very carefully about exactly whom do we give these medicines to. And the other aspect is that they're very, very expensive. So they work really well. They work really well on a very selected population, perhaps, but then they're also very expensive. And so increasingly, clinical pharmacologists are being trained in things such as pharmacoeconomics. We have a limited health dollar. How do we spend this money in a better way in order to get the better health outcomes for the patients that we're serving in the community? So unfortunately for me as a clinical pharmacologist, I still have to learn about half-lives and things such as agonists and antagonists. But for a lot of the students, what we've tried to do in our training is to try and de-emphasize some of that basic learnings that they've had to learn to try and keep it to the absolute bare minimum. In my teaching, I try and basically teach them just pretty much two equations. So one is the equation for half-life and the other equations for steady-state concentration and that's it. And even then, if they don't know the equation, as long as they know the concepts, I'm very happy with that. Because I think that as medicine is changing, because the medicines we're using are changing, then, you know, the only way we can get students to better appreciate some of these concepts around precision medicine and when it's appropriate to use these more expensive biologics is really if we spend less time teaching him some of the core things that, you know, would have taken up half the exam marks when you and I went through our pharmacology course.
Right. What about with these biologics, though? Are the clearances affected by renal or liver disease as much as these other old-fashioned type drugs are used, or are they less of an issue too?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So traditionally, we've always thought about small molecules that these might be, for example, you know, medicines such as atenolol and propranolol. So the sort of things that are made in factories. We tend to think of them in terms of having a clearance through the liver or the kidney. We tend to think of those things such as their clearance being affected by other drugs, as well as things such as liver disease and kidney disease. Biologics are very, very different. So the way that they work is that they're proteins and they're made not in factories, but in bioreactors. They're made so that they're usually given as an infusion or a subcutaneous injection. They then circulate around the circulation, and the way that they're actually cleared is usually by binding to the receptor that they work on. So a very common example is a drug called infliximab. So this binds to tumor necrosis factor. So if you have someone who has very severe Crohn's disease, where they have a lot of tumor necrosis factor, then when you give the infliximab, the drug binds very quickly to its targets and it's then taken out of circulation. And so the clearance of that drug is very, very rapid. As the patient's condition improves, partly as a result of the infliximab treatment, then there's less tumor necrosis factor. And then the half-life is extended and the clearance of the infliximab is reduced. The clearance of infliximab is not really affected by things such as other drugs the patient might be taking for their Crohn's disease, and it's not really affected by things such as kidney disease or liver disease. So really is quite a different paradigm in terms of how we use these drugs and how we think about their dosing. If you're interested more on monoclonal antibodies and biologics, there's a post on my Instagram page at Pharmateen Studies that kind of goes through some of this content.
Well, that'd be excellent for the medical students to have a look at, actually. But one of the big issues for orthopedics is venous thrombosis, which I've always suspected relates to a lot of genetic factors, even if we haven't found the actual underlying cause. Biologically, it's looking towards preventing pulmonary embolus and venous thrombosis at all, or how's that heading?
Yeah, no, you're actually right. There's not a lot that I sort of know specifically in this area. So looking at the underlying causes is not an area that I know particularly well. I think part of the difficulty, as you'd appreciate, is that, you know, if we look at the area of orthopedics and we look at vast numbers of patients that you're seeing and the huge variability between those, you know, there's a huge variability in terms of the patients that you're seeing. Well, even though we're very, very much worried about pulmonary emboli, in actual fact, the incidence of it these days is relatively low because of the standards and the processes that you guys have around, you know, giving prophylaxis and things. So it's always very, very difficult to try and tease out a signal of what it is about those patients amongst all the noise of all the different things that's happening with them. So, yeah, it's a really, really difficult area to research, I imagine, to try and sort of get to the underlying cause. I would imagine what you would need to do is to take all the patients going through and having orthopedic operations and do a lot of genetic analysis on them to try and tease out these different factors, along with a whole bunch of different, you know, operative factors, and patient factors, and other medication factors, and nursing factors, I suspect as well, and physio and other sort of things. I suspect that that would be very, very difficult to tease out. I guess it's an area where increasingly we're seeing artificial intelligence being applied. So where you have an electronic health record, all that information ideally is documented in an electronic health record. And so you can then apply artificial intelligence to that. And we've been involved in some artificial intelligence studies looking at extracting information out of the electronic health record, because it's kind of the only way that we're going to be able to get our heads around all this vast amount of information that we need to analyze to try and get the answers that we need.
So obviously this electronic health record is very similar to our registry, which we have in orthopedics, looking at the replacements we perform on shoulders, hips and knees, and obviously a very important way of analysing data.
Yeah, that's right. I guess one of the things we're really, really fortunate about, particularly the electronic health record in South Australia, is that it does document every single medication the patient receives, and it documents it in a very, very standardized way. So one of the things you would appreciate in terms of trying to do research, and that's why registries are so helpful, is that if people just kind of free text things in, it is, you know, less useful. Whereas all medications are codified, all the doses, routes, frequencies, it's all codified. So from one point of view, people complain about having to prescribe an electronic health record because it does take longer. But one of the advantages it has is that the roughly 5% of every single prescription, which is missing some of that information, no longer occurs. But what it also does mean is that for people like myself who are interested in quality use of medicines, either at a sort of medication governance level in the hospital or at a research level, all that information is actually very accurately documented. And also the nursing staff also have to document every time they're giving the medication. So we're very, very fortunate from that point of view. One of the things that we'd really like is to have better information regarding, you know, what the medicines are used for, what the patient's comorbidities are. In most electronic health records, then that sort of information is not mandatory. That information is often a bit poor. But certainly we've done a lot of really interesting studies to try and translate what we found in the electronic health record into practice.
Excellent. And I believe you're telling me the other day this data has been used for research, both for medical students producing papers, which can help progress their career, as well as also influencing practice. So it's great to know that this data is actually useful and that the information into the electronic health records is actually comes to actually fruition down the track.
Absolutely. And I think that once we start to get to the point of with the new Adelaide Medical School MD program, where students will have to do a research placement, then I think a lot of students would be very interested in looking at big data, artificial intelligence, and getting the data out of our health record. But also, I mean, what a wonderful opportunity to be able to leverage off, you know, the very talented students that we have to be able to look at that data and actually be able to say meaningful things about how we're managing patients to be able to improve that. I think that's, you know, something that we all look forward to doing more.
Excellent. Well, look, Sepp, over the years, you've probably seen a lot of advancements in different types of medicines. What are the main ones you've seen? You know, obviously, the biologics are the key ones, but what in particular, what area have been the main advancements? And perhaps you could give a clinical example of where it's come in handy.
Yeah, look, I think it probably would be the area of the biologics. I think that they've really been kind of transformative in terms of how conditions are treated. If we look at some of the cancers and how previously, you know, when I was going through med school in the early 1990s, then, you know, many cancers were death sentences. And now we're seeing that for a number of quite specific cancers, there's been kind of a revolution in terms of the response you can get, and it's no longer a death sentence. My urge and plea to the students would be, though, to remember that those specific treatments, though, with the biologics only apply to a small number of patients overall, and the vast majority of patients that you will see will still be on a large number of very commonly prescribed medications. And it's not really good care, good pharmacology, good therapeutics, good prescribing. It's not really about finding the best and the newest biologics. It's really about getting the basics right. And I guess that's what we try and emphasize in our prescribing teaching. And a lot of my Instagram posts are about just getting the basics right. And that's really about making sure that, you know, what we're delivering for the patient is something that they want, that they're sort of buying into, that, you know, we prescribe medicines appropriately that's suitable for the patient, and that we monitor the outcomes, that we communicate effectively with other clinicians, that, you know, we make sure we get the right diagnosis and the patient is then in a proper, you know, multidisciplinary care. And I guess another example of that is I recently put up a post about the management of heart failure and how that's a bit like making a pizza. But one of the things that's different about making a pizza is that making a pizza is something that an individual drug, but actually running a pizza restaurant, maybe I should do an analogy of that on my posts. It's really about multiple different people all sort of working collaboratively together. So working together and working with clinical pharmacists, with other allied health practitioners and nursing staff for the complex patients that in fact are the patients that everyone sees every day. For the vast majority of your work, it's not about blockbuster drugs. It still is about basic care and about basically working together well as a team.
I'd like to let you know that AussieMed is supported by HealthShare. HealthShare is a digital health company that provides solutions for patients, GPs, and specialists across Australia. Two of HealthShare's products are Better Consult, a pre-consultation questionnaire that allows GPs to know a patient's agenda before the consult begins, as well as HealthShare's Specialist Referrals Directory, a specialist and allied health directory helping GPs find the right specialist.
Yes, that's a good analogy in a working team environment. What about the scenario, though, where you've got a patient with cardiorenal syndrome where the cart's not producing high enough blood pressure to perfuse the kidneys, but giving the fluid overload actually then causes issues to the kidneys? How do you manage that, and have the biologics got a role to play?
Yeah, unfortunately, for cardiovascular medicines, we haven't really had a lot of useful input from biological medicine. I think it's because the heart is still seen very, very much as a mechanical pump issue. When we look at the management of heart failure, we're thinking of that more and more as a neurohumoral issue where the heart's really sitting in this sort of complex mix of hormones. And by adjusting and manipulating the hormones, we can get better outcomes. But if you're looking at things such as, you know, blood pressure and perfusion to the kidney, we're still seeing that predominantly as very, very much a mechanical process. What's really important there, again, is about sort of good, decent prescribing practice. So it's about making an adjustment to the dose of a medication, about communicating effectively to the patient about what the expectation of that is, and then monitoring for the outcomes. One of the things that we tend to see, which is quite frustrating, is that there might be a new medicines added, or it might be adjusted. And there's just no appropriate follow-up of that individual patient. So they're then seen, for example, in outpatients in the hospital, something's changed, and they're then seen 6 months or a year later. The communication then to the GP about exactly what's happened may be very poor. And so what happens is they then present to the GP a month or so later with worsening renal function or feeling very, very dizzy and lightheaded, exactly as you said, Gavin, because their blood pressure is low. Because they're then feeling dizzy and lightheaded and they're feeling frail, and then, you know, the GP may then refer them to a geriatrician who then reviews them because they're frail and adjusts their medication back. You know, the original specialist that added in the medicine has got no visibility of what the GP's done, has got no visibility of what the geriatrician is saying. So it's very, very common for these complex patients with disorders such as cardiorenal syndrome, which are really very difficult to manage, to kind of be kicked around multiple different specialists. And what you really need is everyone on the same page, managing this patient in a very, very consistent way, looking at what they're doing with the medication and then what the outcomes are. When we're talking to our students, we're often talking about therapeutic trials. We make a change, we look at the outcome of that change, and then we have a look at what we need to change next time. And we continuously, iteratively go around making these therapeutic trials to try and achieve the outcome we can. And unfortunately, it just requires a lot of good communication and consistency. A lot of the times in our public outpatients is often missing.
Excellent. Well, let's put forward a case scenario where you have a patient who comes in, a very common one in the orthopedic world, a patient who's got a bit of heart failure, he's got a bit of diabetes, he's also got some reflux and on anti-inflammatory medication. How would you manage that and where would you start?
That's a great example. It's a really, really good question, Gavin. I think one of the things that, you know, we often tend to do is just to take time to make sure we have all the facts. Unfortunately, in clinical pharmacology, we have a bit more time and we have, you know, more resources in our MAC service. So for example, we have a clinical pharmacist who's able to contact the community pharmacist as well as the GP to try and get all that information. So one of the things that would often happen is, you know, that patient who, for example, presents on an orthopedic ward and they often have, you know, other comorbidities and other conditions, it's really difficult to get that history of exactly what issues they have and what medications they've been taking. So that's often the first place to start. And when we're looking at trying to reconcile and trying to integrate their medication and their overall management, the first thing to think about is, you know, exactly what does this patient need or want? And, you know, we often tend to think of that in the short term. Nonsteroidals, great for pain for many patients, but unfortunately, they're really bad for the patient in terms of things such as their kidney function and worsening heart failure. But it's really important to have a conversation with the patient about, you know, what's important to them. Because for many patients, even if we stop the nonsteroidal because we're worried about their heart, if they're not, they're just going to go back and take the ibuprofen or just purchase some Nurofen over the counter at the chemist's. Working with the patient to identify what's important with them is a really, really good place to start. What we often find is that if you start with that, then you can then work through out of all the different things you can do. There might be 7 or 8 different changes you can make. Oftentimes, it's about just identifying what are the 2 or 3 things I need to do next? What's really, really important here? What's really important to the patient? And the advantage is if you work with the patient in terms of what's important with them, it's much easier to get them on board and much easier to get them to be adherent to the changes you're going to make. And the other thing is to kind of do it in a step-by-step way. What we often find is that we get our trainees and they talk about, look, I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to make these changes. You know, this person should also have a bone mineral density scan. You go, yeah, that's fine. You know, it's really, really important for you to think holistically around the patient. But the other bit is really to prioritize and think about, well, what are my top two or three things? And what's important for this patient in terms of their perspective? And then to bring about one change at a time and to work with the patient and their family to bring about that change. You know, my advice would be that, sure, sit back, see the whole patient, gather all the information. But then the next step is really to use your clinical nous and work with the patient to prioritize what's really important and to then make a plan for making that one thing happen. And what we often find is that, you know, you make that one thing happen, it all goes pear-shaped, and you make new plans, or you make that one thing happen, the patient's really happy, and they're then really keen for the second thing, the third thing. You find that once you got the patient and their family on board, you can then make a lot more changes that you previously wouldn't have been able to make.
Excellent. Well, that's a good approach to any aspects of medicine. Certainly make one change at a time and reassess the situation, and applies to all aspects of life, not only just in medicine.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If we think about the clinicians we really, really admire, you know, people that you really, really look up to and mentors, you know, they're always people who just did that really, really well. They were able to look at the whole situation, the whole patient, but they had a laser focus to say, at the moment, this is what's important and I need to do this and take care of this issue before moving on to that. Certainly that's been my experience with really good general physicians that come to mind. And I think that many students will find once they sort of get into fourth, fifth, and sixth year that medicine can be quite overwhelming in terms of all the different things that we see with our, you know, complex patients. And that's fine. You know, that's understandable. But I guess the good news is that if you just try and identify what the really critical things are in this patient and just focus on that and just make sure you do that really well. If the patient's blood pressure is really high and that's then, you know, making their kidney function worse or is making their heart failure worse or giving them angina, then spend time with the patient, explain to them why their blood pressure is high, what you're going to do, think about the medication you're going to start, and then bring that patient back in a couple of weeks to look at the outcomes in terms of the blood pressure. Don't just do a quick single blood pressure assessment in a hurried way with all their clothes on. Maybe get an ambulatory blood pressure monitoring so that you actually get a good sense of what the effect of that medication's been. And people who are able to really focus on doing those simple things well are often the clinicians that we admire most and, you know, most respected by patients as well.
Excellent. It's good to hear. Look, with this pandemic, there's been a lot of changes in our world, not only just wearing the mask, but also with all the Zoom meetings we now attend and other technological advances. Can I ask you what have been the major advances from this pandemic that you've seen in the pharmacological world?
Yeah, this is really fascinating. I think there's been probably three different areas. I think one of the things has been I used to sort of lecture about treating viruses to various sort of groups. And we always used to say that treating viruses compared to treating bacteria is always a little bit difficult because the virus often sits inside the cell. And to try and target the virus without actually affecting the host cell is really, really difficult. And so traditionally, we haven't had good antivirals. I think what we've demonstrated with COVID is that actually, if the whole world and the whole scientific community gets behind it, it is absolutely amazing that over the last really a year, year and a half, we've had such amazing transformations in the way that this virus has been treated, from, you know, prevention to treatment with dexamethasone to try and deal with the inflammatory change to now a large number of very specific treatments for the actual virus itself. And also how that information has been propagated. For those people listening who aren't aware, there is a Living COVID Guidelines site, which you can just Google, and it has up-to-date information at a very sort of deep granular level about the latest evidence to do with COVID. And the fact that, you know, the way that the whole sort of scientific community has been able to, you know, stand up and collaboratively work to create so many different treatments, I think that's been unique. So I think if we can sort of garner that success and get it to apply to other areas, you know, whether it's obesity or climate change and other sort of challenges that we have, it'd be very, very exciting to see. I think the second area has also been in terms of the public being involved in research. So previously, people who were involved in research were usually patients, for example, cancer patients who perhaps didn't have too many other options. Now we're seeing a lot of healthy individuals taking part in vaccine research as a way of contributing towards public health. And I think the perception of people being involved in research has really, really changed. So many of the heroes of the vaccines that we've developed were actually the individuals who actually volunteered their time, as well as obviously their bodies and their serum, for being involved in research. And I think that that's been really very exciting as well. And I think the other thing that's happened with COVID has been it's broken down a lot of the rules about how we've done healthcare in the past. So we've always had very, very rigid structures in terms of how we did outpatients, how we did telehealth. This pandemic has really thrown a lot of those assumptions that we've made out the window and introduced us to new possibilities. So I kind of look forward to having someone who's interested in health systems research. I'm looking forward to being able to do healthcare in a very, very different way based on everyone's experience of the challenge of the pandemic and how we've changed the way things have been done. You know, one of the things I'm sure you would have seen this in orthopedics, Gavin, is, you know, we have done things for a long time because that's always the way we've done it. Well, a lot of that's been thrown out the window. And I think that hopefully, you know, a lot more clinicians are open to doing things in different ways. And I think when it comes to challenging how chronic disease is managed and how integrated care is managed, how we manage and tackle issues such as polypharmacy, multimorbidity, we really have to shake up our healthcare system. And as someone who's involved in healthcare research in that way, I'm really looking forward to some of the different ways we might be able to shake things up.
Excellent. Well, obviously, every cloud has its silver lining, and it's good to hear there have been some positives that come out of this awful pandemic. And once again, I'd like to thank you for coming on AussieMedEd. It's been great having you on board, Professor Sapir Shakib, a very busy man who's got a lot in his plate. I really appreciate your time. Thank you once again, Sepp.
Fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure, and all the best for you and the other podcast contributors.
I'd like to thank you very much for listening to our podcast. I'd like to remind you that the information provided today is just for general medical advice and does not pertain to one particular medical condition or one way of treating a particular condition. If you have any concerns about information raised today, please do not hesitate to contact your general practitioner for further information. We hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and please don't hesitate to give us a like or tell your friends about it or give us a positive review. We look forward to presenting another podcast to you in the near future on a different topic. Until then, stay safe. Thank you very much.